Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. We have become accustomed to the uncommon intelligence of Diana West, one of our regulars here at Secure Freedom Radio. She contributes each week to this program, and we've asked her to do so once again in connection with some very important developments of the past few days. Diana, of course, is a syndicated columnist of many years, now a blogger par excellence at dianawest.net, and you can find her writings at the Daily Caller and elsewhere. She is also the author of two best-selling books, Death of the Grown-Up and American Betrayal. It's always a delight to have her, especially today. Welcome, Diana. Good to talk with you.
Thank you. I'm so happy to be here to talk with you.
You have been, of course, for some time now, one of the champions of Donald Trump, and I think especially his policy, much discussed during the course of the campaign and intermittently since, that he called America First. And yet you've observed, in connection with the speech that he made night before last about his new strategy for Afghanistan, that that may actually be Afghanistan first rather than America first. Talk a little bit about your thoughts as to what he has announced and where we go from here, Diana.
Yes, well, this was a great betrayal of his campaign promise, of his core beliefs that we were watching him develop on the campaign trail last year, specifically the America First foreign policy, which he quite audaciously expanded on, even as the left and the establishment right sought to paint that as some kind of, quote, isolationist theory, isolationist program that would somehow destroy America's place in the world. He specifically spoke of his desire to seek new people in the foreign policy arena who were not associated with our defeats in Iraq and Afghanistan, either on the diplomatic or the military scene. And yet what we see this week with the plan to ramp up in Afghanistan, to try to win something there undefined and, I believe, unwinnable, with the very same people who, even at the height of the American and allied engagement of 150,000 troops or more, could not prevail. And so this, to me, is a victory for the military-industrial complex, as Ann Coulter has said, and I believe that. And it's also a tremendous disappointment in terms of understanding and anticipating Donald Trump's own nerve to hold to what we believed were his values.
I'm not a big admirer of this concept of the military-industrial complex, I must tell you. I think that what we're looking at is a dispute, a disagreement about how best to try to protect ourselves from what has come out of Afghanistan in the past and may yet come again. But I wonder, Diana, whether the generals who have propounded this approach and that I think you've just described as among those that the president shouldn't be listening to, are going to get us into a mode where we're back to something akin to what we had before. I don't see the 150,000, but I do know that General McMaster, the national security advisor of the president, was urging 50,000 troops. My own view of this is that we ought to be moving away from all of that, not withdrawing, but to adopt something along the lines of what Eric Prince has been discussing of a contractor and CIA run much smaller footprint that, you know, supports the killing of jihadis, but doesn't bleed us dry, either in terms of literally loss of life or the national treasure. But talk a little bit about McMaster and Mattis and perhaps Kelly and their experiences, especially through the prism of the man you've called to our attention at your website, dianawest.net, Major Fred Galvin. His thoughts.
Yes, I would love to. And I've got Major Galvin's statement at my website, which I do urge people to read because it is quite striking given his own experience in the battlefield in Afghanistan and also Iraq, as a matter of fact.
Remind us what that was, though, Diana. What was Fred Galvin's experience there?
Well, it's quite extensive. He was a leader of the special operators that the Marines set up for the first time in country that became involved in a firefight on their one of their very first forays that was an ambush. And it was one of these meet and greet with the local elders, and they were ambushed. They were probably set up.
The meet and greet promoted by sort of the rules of engagement of the day of this counterinsurgency strategy.
Yes, and they responded according to how they'd been trained. They executed their mission perfectly. But what the leadership in the military did, and this includes now General Nicholson, was immediately throw them to the wolves and assume that they had created a massacre, had participated in a massacre of civilians, as the Afghans claimed. They were disgraced. They were General Nicholson prostrated himself publicly. And he had this was Fox Company, he ejected them from Afghanistan and had Fred Galvin relieve himself of his command in front of his men. Well, they were exonerated by an investigation, and what they are now seeking, and Representative Walter Jones, among others, are trying to do for them, is have the Pentagon or the Marines recognize their exoneration, because these men have had their careers and also personal lives ruined by this slander. It impedes them, for example, in seeking employment, and it has also ruined their own personal lives in various ways. But I think what's really important here to understand is President Trump gave up on the notion of Islamic terrorism in his address on Afghanistan. And I think this takes us back to a completely Sino-Islam blindness as to what the battlefield entails.
Promoted by General McMaster, let us be clear, very much his mode.
Promoted by General McMaster, let's be very clear. Exactly. And so what we're seeing, but this was also part and parcel of the Pentagon establishments, not just McMaster. We've been dealing with this for 10, 15 years now. And I think what's very important, to understand, however, is that any engagement in Afghanistan is to secure a Sharia state. I'm all for killing terrorists that threaten the United States. I have long considered terrorists on a mountaintop in Afghanistan to be less threatening than terrorists sneaking in with Islamic immigration, with the migration in Europe, etc. This is where the threat to the West comes, not on a mountaintop in Afghanistan, is my own feeling. But what we have to face is our government is once again looking at this, the expansionist Islam, with a blindness to Islam that is now going to further engage us in perpetuating another Sharia state. We set up a Sharia state in Iraq. That didn't work out so well. We set up another one in Afghanistan. That is where we are now. And now we're going back to further entrench this dependency, the billions of dollars that continue to be spent. It's like an unfunded contingency. This goes on and on. It's welfare for the world, and it's absolutely a crime that Donald Trump would campaign on reversing this and yet then become completely enveloped by it.
I couldn't agree with you more, Diane, on this central point which you're making, which is that we've got a blindness towards Sharia supremacism, I think is the best way to describe it, and that is manifesting itself in lots of different places. The battlefield in Afghanistan is perhaps one of the most distant. I do think it's important not to be routed out of there by these Sharia supremacists, because I think that will simply reinforce their narrative that we are going to be defeated by them inevitably, which will only compound our problems elsewhere, including here at home. But your key point is we are confronting, or failing to confront, but we are facing, at the very least, this threat growing in our own country as well as overseas. And that point is well taken. In fact, it's the subject of a amicus brief that we've filed in the Supreme Court, urging that Sharia supremacism be used as a filter to prevent the importation of more jihadists here. So this is a subject for another day, and we will have to come back to you on Antifa and Donald Trump in Phoenix and so much more. We've just run hard out of time, but thank you for yours today, Dinah, as always, as well as your thoughtful and sometimes provocative offerings. We look forward to visiting with you again next week. Next up, we'll speak with Ben Weingarten. We'll take stock with him about some of these issues and more. Straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back, joined by one of the brightest young minds in the country's national security firmament, as far as I'm concerned. He is Benjamin Weingarten, the founder and CEO of Change Up Media, LLC, a 2015 Publius Fellow of the Claremont Institute, and a very active contributor to the public policy debate at outlets like Breitbart, the Federalist National Review, Newsmax, and PJ Media. He's always a welcome guest here, and I'm delighted to have him back. Ben, thanks so much for joining us.
Frank, thanks so much for that delightful introduction. I really appreciate it.
Well, all true. Let me ask you about Afghanistan. I just had a rather bracing conversation with Dinah West, our mutual friend, who's very critical of what the president has done here. What are your thoughts, Ben, on his new strategy, as he calls it, not just for Afghanistan, but for the region more generally?
Well, I think it's important that the president provided the needed context of the fact that Afghanistan does not exist in isolation. It's a battleground which serves as a proxy for a variety of forces. And so we, of course, have a vested interest in Afghanistan not becoming a breeding ground for the worst of the worst actors in the Middle East. I think we still need to hear a little bit more as to how we define winning. It's obviously very positive that the president and those in his administration more broadly have supported a loosening of the frankly suicidal rules of engagement, which basically give the enemy an advantage on the battlefield. I will say a big positive that was brought to the fore by the president was the idea of leveraging India against Pakistan. It's very clear that Pakistan plays both sides, as do many actors in the Middle East. And I think it's also very clear that India should be a bulwark, should be an ally.
You know, I'll be talking shortly with Michael Dougherty about this Pakistani national-run IT operation in the U.S. House of Representatives. These guys were not just stealing computer equipment, but perhaps making available to others, possibly including the Pakistani intelligence service, the ISI. This is just another example of what is at best a double game played by our so-called Pakistani allies. And I'm with you in terms of adding to the pressure there. I'm also with you, I have to say, about being unclear about exactly what President Trump means when he says we will win. Do you have any concern, given what we've seen to date, that then we're going to be watching more of the same in terms of the U.S. military footprint, more treasure squandered, particularly in a corrupt society, more loss of American personnel's lives?
All that said, I think the president, in his heart of hearts, and as he indicated in his speech, still is inclined to say what is the ultimate objective here. And I think the best argument that can be made is that if and where there are jihadists, we will hunt them down no matter where they are, and Afghanistan happens to be a particularly large breeding ground for them.
I guess my view of this, for what it's worth, is that winning is persuading the jihadists in Afghanistan, of which there are many, not just the ones we're fighting, but many others, needless to say, that they are not going to prevail. And that's a very subjective judgment, but I think there are things that we can do that impress that upon them. You've written a very interesting piece at PJ Media about the tech blacklisting of counter-jihadists, which is, of course, the goal of the Muslim Brotherhood, silencing those of us who are pushing back against their Sharia supremacism in this country. And you use a turn of phrase which is near and dear to my heart. It comes out of their explanatory memorandum. And that is sabotaging our miserable house by our own hands as a way of destroying Western civilization from within. Talk a little bit about what you see going on in this regard.
Yeah, so what really spurred this story, and of course we should note that the left has been trying to stifle particular speech which exposes Sharia supremacism, the ideology of Islamic supremacists more broadly, because that's one of the sacred cows for the left. But in any event, the specific instance that spurred this piece was an article and questions submitted by ProPublica, which casts itself as an investigative journalist institution, but which is backed in large part by clearly leftist progressive donors. And ProPublica reached out to several groups that were listed by either the ADL or the Southern Poverty Law Center. We don't know who's on the ADL's list, but the Southern Poverty Law Center's is right out there for all to see. Groups classified as haters, essentially, and extremists, quote-unquote, and went out to them with a series of questions to basically chill those groups. What the questions asked were basically, justify why you are not a hate group, and then tell us how you fund yourself and what mechanisms you use to fund yourself. And it's very clear that those questions were meant to chill and to scare the groups on the list, and also to give them a heads up that a hit piece was essentially coming.
And more broadly, a campaign to try to take that funding and also information technology support away from them, right?
Exactly. And of course, we should note that the left tries to shut down competing opinion in a number of ways. First, you have Lawfare, where you have actual laws that they try to get on the books, and they'll be under the guise of anti-hate speech or anti-blasphemy. Then you have litigation against those they don't like. Then you have toxifying groups by trying to smear them. As we've seen, for example, is Sebastian Gorka in the Trump administration, all of the horrific articles that have been leveled at him to attempt to make him toxic and thus force him out of the White House. And we see this writ large among those who don't toe to the left's line when it comes to Islamic supremacism. And then lastly, of course, they have striking at your ability to operate by threatening your wallets. And that was what this ProPublica campaign came down to, was seeking to get web services like PayPal, for example, as well as other services, to restrict the use of organizations like yours, like Robert Spencer's, like many others, clearly not hate or extremist organizations, clearly organizations that are dedicated to defending and protecting America against jihadists, and to try to get those services to restrict usage. And in other words, stop you from operating freely and openly and independently. And the backlash, in particular when it came to PayPal and Robert Spencer's site, and PayPal restricted Robert Spencer's site and said, you're no longer allowed to use our service, the backlash was so strong in social media and elsewhere that PayPal relented, and Robert Spencer declared victory in this particular battle. But I think this is just one battle in what is going to be an ongoing war to seek to stifle competing opinion when it comes to views on jihad, Islamic supremacism. The left is wittingly or unwittingly, and I will go with unwittingly until we learn more, basically executing upon what the jihadists themselves have always wanted, which is to stifle all competing opinion when it comes to understanding their ideology. So when sites that disseminate quality information are threatened by the left and by tech companies in league with the left, for whatever reason they're in league with the left, the end result is basically serving the jihadists and, in effect, sabotage by our own hands, as the Muslim Brotherhood called for in their infamous explanatory memorandum.
Ben Weingart, much food for thought there. As always, I'm appreciative of it. I think I agree with everything, except perhaps that you're being a little too charitable to suggest that the left is not wittingly helping these Islamists when it's pretty clear there's a lot of collusion in what we've come to call the red-green axis between them. despite their differences, particularly with respect to the end state, they seek a common immediate purpose, which is the destruction of this country. Ben, we have to leave it at that for the moment. We are over time, but I appreciate, as always, the work that you have been doing, both in the public sector and, of course, at ChangeUp Media LLC. I hope you'll come back to us again in the very near future. Next up, we will talk with Christine Douglas-Williams about what is happening in practice in the various respects that we've just been discussing in Canada, our neighbor to the north, right after this.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. Our guest for this segment is an extraordinary woman from north of the border, Christine Douglas-Williams, a multi-time prize-winning journalist in Canada, both for her writing and for her television production. She is the author of The Challenge of Modernizing Islam and a federally appointed director with the Canadian Race Relations Foundation, which is a bit of a drama at the moment, and we're anxious to draw her out about it. Christine, thank you so much for taking a few minutes to talk with us about what's happening on your side of the border, as well as what's headed our way based on your own experiences. Thank you for your time today.
It's my pleasure to be back, Frank.
I'm thinking, oh, Canada, the sort of opening lines of your national anthem are appropriate here. What, Christine, if you could summarize quickly, is going on with respect to efforts by the Trudeau government and Parliament and even some of the provincial governments to impose what I can only describe as Sharia blasphemy restrictions on Canadians in connection with, well, what's called Islamophobia?
Frank, there has been aggressive attempt to shut down free speech in Canada. And it didn't just start overnight and culminate with this recent attack on me, of which an article came out in the National Post, the Globe and Mail, and even Metro News. But this attack started a while back when this Islamophobia aggressive campaign that's being pushed by CareCan, I mean, they changed their name to the National Council of Canadian Muslims, and they did so for political reasons. Some call it deceptive reasons. But to show you how bad it is, they pushed for Islamophobia charters, which are now active in six major cities, as well as an Islamophobia hotline. What that means is anybody who criticizes Islam or gives out information and reports on what's actually taking place within Islam, they're being witch hunted. So what happened in my case is on a trip to Iceland, where Robert Spencer and myself did a speech. One of the issues that stemmed from that was I subsequently wrote an article entitled My Warning to Icelanders, which is published on Jihad Watch. But in addition to that, they asked me for a shorter version in Iceland, and that was translated and published in the largest newspaper, the Morgunblaðið, in Iceland. Well, that created a firestorm because a social justice warrior who has a record of going after conservative politicians and reporters, not just that, but this guy has ties to very violent groups in Iceland. And he started calling up the federal government about my speech, my warning to Icelanders that to be careful, particularly about stealth jihadists, because they smile at you, they shake your hand. Take the Holy Land Foundation case where these unindicted co-conspirators were listed. These are people like CARE, the North American Islamic Trust, ISMA, ICNA. And when you look at the effects of even the Muslim Student Associations and the hate that they spew on campuses, they get away with reprieve. But these unindicted co-conspirators that have been found connected with terrorism financing, they get away with reprieve as well.
Hamas is one of the organizations that they were directly associated with. And Christine, just to put this all in sort of a more accessible form, because you've given us a lot to work with here, the government of Canada is now effectively being called upon to purge you from the Canadian Race Relations Foundation, as I understand it, at the insistence of these, I think dignifying them as social justice. I mean, these are simply radical leftists who are in cahoots with the Islamists of CareCan and beyond. And this is what's so concerning to me is we're seeing this effort to silence freedom of speech. We're seeing people like yourselves who exercise it responsibly and I think quite creditably in a way that is effectively imposing a foreign and totalitarian Sharia blasphemy program on a free people. It's scandalous and it's alarming. And it brings me to the related point, which I know you're very much aware of, in part because the work you do with our friend Robert Spencer, who appeared on this program earlier this week, talking about how his organization, jihadwatch.org, is being harassed and perhaps endangered by the concerted effort of folks on this side of the border to try to silence him as well. Tell us, if you would, Christine, how you see this in terms of the long-term threat to the character of Western civilization.
Frank, I see it as short-term and long-term. I subsequently received a letter, a personal registered letter, from the Minister of Heritage, Melanie Jolie, about my writings for Jihad Watch. And she demanded an explanation, of which I did not answer. So eventually, the whole shenanigan was dealt with in the media. So now it's public. But there is a witch hunt, and it's coming from this motion M103, this anti-Islamophobia motion, that's coming directly from that very Heritage Department, of which the Canadian Race Relations Foundation exists in.
Remind us what this M103 is about and where it's been moved.
It's Canada's anti-Islamophobia motion, M103. And the key point here is that the real victims here of intolerance and human rights abuses are those that are being targeted, killed even, globally, persecuted, women, FGM, honor killings. The list goes on, including people even being murdered for apostasy, for their religious choices. So Jihad Watch reports on this.
And many of these are Muslim, lest we forget. These are people, particularly Muslim women, who are being subjected to these horrors, and others as well. So, Christine, as you know, we unfortunately don't pay nearly as much attention to what's going on in Canada as we should. But this M103 is now effectively, I guess it's not the law of the land exactly, but it has been promulgated by the parliament there, as I understand it. And it is setting the stage, perhaps, for enforcing legislation in due course. Is that right?
You described it very well, because M103 is a motion that passed in Parliament last winter, and that is the genuine concern of Canadians that it could and is inching its way up to legislation, because when motions are passed in Parliament, it does guide legislative action. So it is not out of the genuine logic.
The realm of the possible, for sure. And Christine, as you probably are aware, there's a similar move afoot. I'm shocked and horrified to say that Marco Rubio joined Dianne Feinstein in the United States Senate to get what turned out to be unanimous approval of a resolution. It's, I guess, not quite as bad as M103, but I think in terms of its thrust, it's very much of the same character that, we mustn't allow people to engage in hateful speech that offends Muslims and the like. And that really inches us as well as you. And the difference, of course, is we have a First Amendment that is supposed to protect our freedom of speech. But as we're seeing day by day, that's being eroded and threatened here as well. So if you had a short message to communicate to the American people listening to this program and beyond about what you're being subjected to personally, as well as in terms of your country, what would that be?
I would say that it starts at people on the front lines, but it's going to come after everybody. And it is affecting our very foundations of democracy. The word Islamophobia is dangerous term. It is a way of Islamist penetration into democracies designed as if it is dealing with anti-Muslim bigotry when it is not. It is a word to shut down free speech, and it's very subtle, and Islamists are very good at playing the victimology card, making it look like they're the ones attacked, when you just need to look globally and see what is happening and see the incursion into Western territories. And even if you look at the Muslim Brotherhood plan for North America, it is outlined in detail. So it is very peculiar the kinds of inroads that these Islamists are making into Western countries.
Well, and particularly peculiar is that we're tolerating it, knowing what we do about their stealth plan, this explanatory memorandum, which, by the way, folks, you can get access to for free at the Centers for Security Policy's website, securefreedom.org. Look for the explanatory memorandum on the general strategic goal of the group in North America. Christine, there's so much more to talk about. I hope you'll join us again very soon to continue this conversation, but I appreciate your warnings, your admonitions, and your courage in standing up to this sort of pressure on that side of the border, as well as helping us understand the ones that are threatening us here as well. Keep it up. Come back to us again very soon, if you would. Next up, we will be speaking with Michael Daugherty about the House IT scandal and what may be afoot there. And more straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back. I'm pleased to say, joined once again by Michael Daugherty. He is a man who we've turned to in the past for commentary and analysis about a subject that he is deeply knowledgeable about, namely cybersecurity and insecurity, for that matter. He is, among other things, the author of The Devil Inside the Beltway, the shocking expose of the U.S. government's surveillance and overreach into cybersecurity, medicine, and small business. He's a senior writer for Cyber Defense Magazine. He is also the CEO of LabMD, a medical testing laboratory. Michael, it's so good to have you with us. Thank you again for taking some time.
Oh, no problem, Frank. Good morning.
I'm trying to figure out what to make of this cyber problem that the Democratic caucus in the House of Representatives has had. By some accounts, there are as many as 80 members of that caucus who have had operating inside their wire, if you will, Pakistani nationals, apparently with the active support and encouragement of Debbie Wasserman Schultz. Can you shed light on what on earth is going on here and the apparent growing concern that these guys weren't just stealing government equipment, but perhaps were stealing sensitive information from these members of Congress as well?
The first question is, why isn't the story even bigger? Because when you hear the story, it's amazing. It is two big lucky breaks happened, or otherwise we'd never know. First of all, a laptop was found in the vestibule in a building on the Hill other than the building Wasserman Schultz's office is in, and yet it was her staff members and then the Capitol Police took it, and she immediately wanted it back instead of wondering how it got there and assisting in any sort of way. And that was concerning. And it turned out that it was this IT guy who's a contractor, he's not an employee, has his own company, who has billed and received payments from the U.S. government for his work in the House of over $4 million over about 7 years. And when this laptop kind of turns into the Capitol Police, he coincidentally closes up shop at his home, rents it, and his kids get pulled out of school. The wife takes off to Pakistan with $12,000 cash, and he rents his house out to a Marine veteran and his currently active military Navy wife. Then no one knows where he's living, but he's still around, but saying he'll be leaving soon. Debbie Wasserman Schultz does nothing but defend him and fight the Capitol Police for the laptop back, and continues paying him. Everyone else stops. So the first question is, how come she wasn't stopped at the Dulles Airport? So she's in Pakistan. Now, Politico runs this story, and then no one picks it up, and nothing. And then Daily Caller starts really honing in on it, because the Marine veteran tenant now finds smashed hard drives in the house that this guy somehow left in his haste, routers, evidence of transferring data, and he believes these are government property, so they shouldn't be in possession anyway. And so he doesn't call the landlord. He calls the authorities, I believe the FBI. So now the FBI is in all over this. Still, Debbie Wasserman-Schultz is in a hearing, you know, going after the Capitol Police, saying there'll be consequences for not handing the laptop back.
And, you know, it wasn't, I gather, until this fellow Imran Awan was stopped trying to flee the country himself that Debbie Wasserman-Schultz finally fires him and starts becoming a little bit less defensive of him and his work product.
Well, she's between a rock and a hard place because he is now wired. Now he has, you know, used a rental property, represented it that it was a primary residence, taken the money, wired $700,000 to Pakistan and tried to get in a plane. So they get him for that. Now, what's fascinating is that's considered a placeholder, but the indictment really is a bit cleaned up on anything else. So he's here, and now this is what's concerning. All the dominoes and the web of connectivity isn't really, at this point, getting gone after. And the question is, the first question is, how did a guy like this get a position like this and get such access? He had her password.
Including, apparently, for the DNC network that she was, at the time, the chairman of.
Note the press and the left screaming, Russia, Russia, Russia. And now with no evidence, and we have Mueller and the whole world going after. And then this is deafening silence.
It's been extraordinary. And I have to ask you, Michael Daugherty, and I know this is perhaps beyond your immediate expertise, but what's at least as peculiar to me has been that with very few exceptions, there's been hardly a peep out of Republicans either about all this. You know, you'd think that at a minimum, this is an opportunity to make hay politically, to say nothing of, you know, getting to the bottom line as to what on earth might have happened in terms of, you know, information security and perhaps national security as well.
Nothing scares a politician more than thinking that his diary is going public. And this guy might have access to everything, who knows?
When you say everything, you mean Republican data as well as Democratic?
You don't know what this guy's got. You don't know what he's got, and he's selling it, I believe. And that's how he's making money as well. And so nothing unifies politicians and bureaucrats more than when you threaten their get-out-of-jail-free card. And when these guys have all their secrets put out, their lack of accountability exposed, they're going to double down. And the first thing they do is whistle past the graveyard. So that's politics 101, and that is why people like Trump happened, because there was more than just defeating the Democrats. It was defeating the Republicans as well.
Yeah. So, Michael, let me just ask you, again, we're talking with Mike Daugherty. He is the CEO of LabMD and the author of The Devil Inside the Beltway. Your expertise is in cybersecurity. Give us just a, as best we can tell from the dots that are out there in public, the level of exposure that these members, perhaps Republicans, certainly, and quite a number of Democrats, may have to, well, you know, the compromise of personal information, their office data, their perhaps committee responsibilities, and even sensitive information associated therewith. What would it mean if this guy had access to all of that? This guy, and by the way, his family members, there were four or five of them that were in this ring. But if they had access to all this sort of stuff, and they may have been selling it perhaps to Pakistani intelligence or Russian intelligence or others, can you give us a sense of the possible exposure here?
It's blackmail, crime, just exposure of hypocrisy. I mean, you know, we were finding out a few days ago that you know, Assange has released emails showing that the Hillary Clinton campaign donated money to Republican campaigns if they go against Trump. So look, what you will learn is how theatrical and hypocritical Washington is between the parties. And because if Debbie Wasserman-Schultz's emails are exposed, those are two-way streets. She doesn't just talk to Democrats. Okay, and it's and what ultimately threatens everything is the whole theater will collapse. That people will know it's not real, it's an act.
And there's a bipartisan sort of collusion, perhaps, between the establishment on both the Republican and Democratic side of the aisles. Fascinating stuff. Again, Michael Daugherty, thank you so much for joining us to explore it. Senior writer for Cyber Defense Magazine and the author of The Devil Inside the Beltway, the shocking expose of the U.S. government's surveillance and overreach into cybersecurity, medicine, and small business. Come back to us again very soon, if you would. I hope the rest of you will come back to us again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.